This episode of GeekWire is part of the Destination Moon Pod Crawl, organized by Seattle's Museum of Flight. This is a collaboration of several podcasts. We're all recognizing the 50th anniversary of the moon landing with stories about the past, present, and future of spaceflight. Other stops on this pod crawl are episodes of the Flight Deck podcast from the Museum of Flight, Sound Effect from KNKX Radio, Radiotopia's The Truth, and Stuff You Missed in History Class. After listening to this episode of GeekWire, be sure to check out our show notes for links to the other podcasts to continue exploring one of the most incredible moments in human history, the Apollo 11 moon landing.
10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Well, I think on one level you can talk about what this meant for humanity.
Alan Boyle is GeekWire's aerospace and science editor.
In 1969, people took their first steps beyond Earth and into the cosmos.
Tower cleared.
Here we got a roll program.
Neil Armstrong reporting their roll and pitch program, which puts Apollo 11 on a proper heading.
On the grand level, you look at that and you think this is going to be a milestone for the millennium.
Plus 30 seconds.
We're getting that buffeting we've become used to. What a moment. Man on the way to the moon.
But on another level, it's about what people can achieve.
Altitude's 2 miles.
How hundreds of thousands of people really came together to do this incredible feat that no one imagined would be possible over the time frame between when JFK made his grand statement.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win.
And then actually doing it by the end of the decade. And that just shows what us hairless monkeys can do when we set our mind to do something.
On this July 20th, 1969.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
I think that was Neil's quote. I didn't understand it.
No, one small step for man, but I didn't get the second phrase.
For people who weren't alive in that time frame, is there a way for them to get a deep appreciation for the significance and the change that this represented?
I think it's actually kind of hard to do that for people who weren't around, because it was a different time back then that you didn't have the global internet knitting societies together or dividing societies from each other. You had television.
His quote was, that's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Footprints of my boots and the treads and the fine sandy particles.
And that was really the medium by which the space effort was presented to the world, and it was a unifying experience.
Oh, thank you, television, for letting us watch this one.
Isn't this something? 240 miles, 1,000 miles out there in the moon, and we're seeing this history
being made.
There
seems to be no difficulty in moving around it.
You had folks all over the world having this shared experience, and there are few experiences, I think, like that today.
Coming up on this special edition of the GeekWire podcast, on the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, we'll talk with veteran space journalist Alan Boyle, and we'll listen in on his conversations with three unsung heroes of the Apollo era. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop. Stay with us as we explore the past, present, and future of the final frontier. You mentioned that this took a very large team of people to accomplish, and you got a chance to talk with three of those people.
We did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what did you learn from your recent conversations with them and their thoughts and perspectives 50 years later?
When you think about the flight directors and the flight controllers who were behind this, I think it's easy to think of them as people who were always in control, who always knew the right thing to do. You know, when Apollo 13 had its problem and they had to bring those astronauts back, they figured out how to put the duct tape around the ventilator so that they could keep the air going and they could bring them back alive. Failure is not an option. But when you talk to these people, it's clear that failure was an option, that it took a lot of smarts, it took a lot of people working together and maybe not always being sure of themselves to do these things that turned into a heroic effort for the space program. For example, you know, we talked with Jerry Griffin and Milt Windler, and they were flight directors for the Apollo 11 mission, and talking about how they didn't always know what they were thinking about doing was going to work, but you just kept at it, and these people were trained to be able to figure this out and find a way to do it and not panic like you or I might panic when we found ourselves in a situation like that. And we also talked with Poppy Northcutt, who was the first flight controller at Mission Control. She was the only woman in the room at Mission Control when Apollo 11 landed, and she started out as a computress. That is the term for a female computer. And in those days, a computer was not a machine. It was a person who did all the calculations for spaceflight. If you've seen the movie Hidden Figures, it's those sorts of people who would write them out and check and make sure that the formulas were right and make sure that the rocket science was followed to the letter, because that was the difference between life and death.
So we're going to play highlights from each of your conversations with these key figures, three of the many hundreds or thousands that took part in this historic accomplishment 50 years ago. So let's start with Poppy Northcutt.
Poppy, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about looking back 50 years when you were in the thick of it. I'm sure you didn't think about how the events of 1969 would be viewed from the perspective of 2019, but here we are.
It's really been sort of a shock to see how much attention this 50th anniversary is going to get. But it was an incredibly significant event. I think it was the technical high point, certainly of the 20th century, and I don't think it's been surpassed to date. And I don't see anything in the near future that compares either.
So, what was it like back then? Did you have a sense of the awesomeness of what you were doing back then, or was it just a job?
Well, it definitely wasn't just a job. I think everybody that worked on the program was acutely aware that this was very much a national priority and national prestige was on the line, and that this was a really singular event. As I said, technologically, I mean, to be able to go to the moon, that was something that, you know, was a matter of science fiction for decades. And I suspect that people going back centuries had looked up at the moon and thought about going there. So, yeah, I think everybody that was associated knew that it was a really singular and important event.
Have previous anniversaries brought attention to what you did and your status as one of the few, if not the only woman who was in the room at Mission Control?
Not really. I talked to Nova on the 50th. Well, it was the 50th anniversary of eight. You know, I did an interview there, but that was just a few months ago. So, no, not really.
Is it because just the anniversary, or is it because people are getting more aware of the role of women in science, and maybe attitudes toward having women in technical fields has been changing lately?
I think it's probably a combination of those things. I think that, you know, 50th anniversaries in and of themselves are sort of notable, and also, you know, when you talk about a 50th anniversary, you're talking about a whole lot of people that were around before may not be around much longer. So, you know, people pay a little more attention to that. And I do think there is a lot more awareness about diversity. I think those images, when people look at, you know, the rooms back then, and what they see are basically a whole bunch of nerdy looking white guys wearing white shirts and black ties, the IBM uniform, so to speak. And that sort of jarring, I think, you know, in today's culture, that there are no black people, there are no Hispanic people, there, you know, just, and no women. I mean, it's, I think it's a little jarring to people. Mm-hmm. And I think on the one hand, I'm sort of one of the few diversity factors around, so that's part of why I've been called.
Another person who is probably getting calls is Joanne Morgan, who was in the firing room for Apollo 11, and in the recently mm-hmm. released documentary, she sticks out very prominently among all those nerdy white guys. Mm-hmm. At Cape Canaveral. Had you been in touch with Joanne Morgan? Did you ever compare notes through the years?
Did not know her, did not know, you know, we were, you know, the few of us that existed, I think we're pretty much in isolation from each other. I mean, I now know that there was a woman, you know, in launch at the Cape. You know, I know there was a woman, I can't remember her name now, who was up in Boston at Draper, you know, but...
Oh, yeah, Margaret Hamilton, I think her name is.
Right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, it's very isolated and separate. I doubt if any of them knew about me. I didn't know about them.
Any lessons learned? Anything that you want to say to women in aerospace or people who are talking again about going to the moon and this time to stay?
Well, I certainly hope that we will go back to the moon and go further still. I mean, go on to Mars and do further exploration. I found it very disappointing that back 50 years ago, right after, you know, Apollo 11, they started immediately cutting back on the program. And to me, that was really wasteful and very short-sighted, because to do something like going to the moon, your efforts, your technological development is very front-end loaded. So it's a sort of crazy that you spend all this money in the front end to get there, and then you don't fly out your advanced missions. Because we never really got into high inclination missions, any of those really advanced missions at all. And I had even worked on some of those, you know, some of the early mission planning for those, even a little bit of Mars work. So it was very disappointing to me that we did not continue on at the time. So I'm pleased that people are talking about going back. I'm not celebrating quite yet, though, because if you're going to do something like this, you have to put the money out to do it. And you have to have real commitment to do it. Focus and commitment. And I don't see the money. So until I see the money, I don't think people are serious.
On the aspect having to do with the status of women, I know that you had a whole career after your time at Mission Control, really focusing on women's rights and reproductive rights and those issues.
And I still work on those. You know, mm-hmm. I'm still very active in that every day. You know, I've been active in that for years. And, you know, expect to continue to be very active. One of the things that, you know, it's heartening to see that there are a lot more women in the control center these days, whether you're talking about JPL or you're talking about NASA. But the numbers overall for women in engineering are still extremely low. I think they're only about 8%, and, you know, which is a vast improvement over next to zero, but still, it's only 8%. in the area of computer science, things are a little disappointing. My understanding is that back in the late 60s, women were right around 30% in computer science, and that's now dropped to 17-18%. So that's very disappointing. And doesn't bode well for women, because we're just going to have more and more jobs in the in the computer era. And women need to be in those jobs because there's going to be other jobs that are phased out over the next decades or so. I think we're going to have, we're already having, and we're going to continue to have a big shift in the workplace. And women need to realize that and think ahead.
One of the things that people talk about a lot when it comes to women in technology is being able to look to role models. There's the old saying, you can't be what you can't see. So how do you feel about being a role model like that?
You know, I think that every woman in technology needs to think about being, the fact that they can influence other people. One of the, something that was really gratifying at the time, way back, when I first got some publicity for being the first woman in the control center during Apollo 8, I got letters from little girls from all around the world telling, and from little boys too, saying I didn't know a woman could do that. So that was, really a highlight of that experience. And then to bring it home even more, about a month ago, I guess, I got a call from the Brazilian consulate here in Houston, which I thought was very strange because I don't know anyone offhand from Brazil, not planning on visiting Brazil anytime soon. So why would the Brazilian consulate be calling me? Anyway, the woman tells me that she's calling because there's a Brazilian woman who works at JPL who wanted to locate me and contact me. Because when she was a little girl in Brazil 50 years ago, she saw news coverage of me, and that influenced her to go into planetary science.
Wow. So did you hook up?
I did. Her name is Rosalie Lopez. She's at JPL, and she is a really fantastic planetary scientist. And I expect to actually see her. I'm going to be in California in a few weeks, and I'm going to meet with her, go on a tour of JPL with her, and I think we're even going to do a joint interview with a Brazilian film crew, which I think will be really quite cool.
Yeah, very cool. Well,
but,
I guess...
I tell girls these days is, don't be a hidden figure. And that's not a criticism in any way of those women who were in the movie and the book, Hidden Figures, but don't be hidden is what I'm saying. Try to be visible because you never know who you're influencing.
What do you think people will take away from what they saw in 1969 and in 2019 with regard to the space effort in general and then maybe the role of women in exploration in particular?
Well, I hope that what they take away from seeing some of the incredible footage, because it's very immersive. It's those of us who were around at the time didn't see anything as spectacular as people can now see with some of this footage that's been released and enhanced and so forth out of the NASA archives. It's very immersive. You feel like you're there right next to the launch pad as it's going up. You feel like you're there as the landing is happening. I mean, it's just really astonishing footage. But I hope that they will really appreciate the degree of teamwork that was involved and the degree of commitment that was involved, as well as feeling the kind of pride that not just Americans felt at the time, but I think people all around the planet felt that we had made a human achievement, not just an American achievement, and recognize that we can really do great things if we make the commitment and work as a team. We can make great things. We can solve great problems. But you do have to focus, and you do have to put your energy, you do have to put your treasure as well as your concentration, your resources behind it. And that, you know, women should be part of that. We hold up half the sky, so we should be as much involved in that as anyone else.
Poppy Northcutt was a NASA flight controller and the only woman in NASA mission control during the Apollo flights. Northcutt took part in planning the trajectory for the Apollo 8 crew's return after a round-the-moon mission in 1968. She also helped to calculate the maneuvers needed to save Apollo 13's crew in 1969. That was after their craft was crippled by an oxygen tank explosion. She and the rest of the Apollo mission operations team won the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1970 for their role in the rescue.
A couple of things I really like about what Poppy said. One is just the idea that these figures, the figures behind the space effort, really should not be hidden, whether they're the African-American women who are portrayed in the Hidden Figures movie, or whether they're people like Poppy or other people who were behind the scenes. I think it's great for them to have their spotlight during this 50th anniversary. The astronauts did mighty feats, but they weren't the only ones. And so anything we can do to highlight what those people have done is really great. And the other thing is that Poppy had a very rich career after leaving the space program, that she's still involved in reproductive rights and in the status of women, that you can't separate what's going on in the space effort from what's going on in society. You have to remember that during the 1960s, there was a lot of turmoil happening and society was changing very quickly. And so you can't put the space effort in a separate category and say, well, this was America's greatest adventure, without remembering that this was something that played a role in perhaps bringing a society that was divided together. And maybe it's the same thing today.
Discussions about the moon are very timely right now, and we'll get more into that when we continue on this special Apollo 11 episode of the GeekWire podcast.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/ITCertsIncluded.
This anniversary comes in the context currently of a new effort by the United States to put people back on the moon. What's the significance of that initiative, and could the Apollo 11 anniversary inspire people to pay more attention, or perhaps inspire the kind of funding that will be required to make that happen? Put those pieces together for us.
I think it certainly will bring more attention to the fact that American astronauts are getting ready to be launched from U.S.-made spacecraft from U.S. soil for the first time since the shuttles were retired. And so that's a big thing. And it might also help to raise the awareness that there are big things coming in the space program, whether it's what Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk are doing, or whether it's this plan to send astronauts back to the moon, perhaps by 2024. We'll have to see what the time frame is, and we'll have to see what the costs are. That's a big issue. And so I don't think it's going to hurt that we have a 50th anniversary around the time where people are considering big changes in space policy. And I think the thing that we have to watch out for is politicizing the whole effort, that we don't want to make it look like, you know, this is a Republican thing or a Democratic thing. And so I hope we don't get in that position where something that is historically nonpartisan somehow becomes partisan, because everything today is becoming partisan.
Alan, how did the Apollo 11 capsule get to the moon? and back.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So there's a big rocket, the Saturn V, and, you know, several stages. And so it would take off from Cape Canaveral. For a while, it was known as Cape Kennedy, get into orbit. And then the command module and the service module would kind of separate, and command module would turn around, and then there would be the lunar module sitting in the fairing of the Saturn V rocket upper stage. And so those two units of the spacecraft, the command module with the service module and the lunar module, would have to dock in Earth orbit and then take off, go into translunar injection. It would fire up its rocket engine to get out of Earth orbit and then make that 225,000-mile trip to lunar orbit. And then the Apollo capsule would have to fire its engine at just the right time to settle into lunar orbit. And so you'd have those two docked craft. And then two of the astronauts would get into the lunar module and separate from the command module. And so in Apollo 11's case, you had Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin in this little bug-like thing called the lunar module. And it would descend to the surface of the moon while Mike Collins was circling in the command module in that gumdrop-shaped spacecraft. And so Neil and Buzz would take their, you know, small steps for humans, for men at the time, and do some moonwalks, and then eventually come back, get in the lunar module, and the top part of the lunar module would take off. The bottom part would be left behind on the moon, and you would come back up to the command module dock. Then you reverse your steps, you come back from the moon, the Apollo capsule jettisons the lunar module and makes its re-entry, opens the parachutes, and then there you are in the ocean with a splashdown. The end.
Every word and every sentence you just spoke was an opportunity for failure.
Right.
And in that way.
And it happened. It happened on Apollo 13. The oxygen tank exploded on the service module, and that was a failure. It was an option. So what do you do about it? And that's where the flight directors come in.
And so that's who you spoke with. You spoke with two of the flight directors on the Apollo 11 mission.
Jerry Griffin and Milt Windler.
Hi, I'm Milton Windler, and I was one of the flight directors on the Apollo program. I worked on 8 and 10 and 11, 13, 14, 15. And I was a flight director on Skylab.
There are so many movies and television shows coming out for the 50th anniversary. We talked about First Man, Apollo 11, the new documentary that came out. Are there things that you feel people should be looking for when they see these movies to kind of get a deeper appreciation of what the achievement was, or maybe some things that people might miss, some things that might not be covered in the movies that are part of the reality?
Well, people building the movies do a pretty good job of that. So I don't know. Of course, they all have different aspects maybe they're looking at, but they probably do a pretty good job, the ones I've seen. I mean, we talked a little bit about some of the things in the Apollo 13 movie, for example, and they did dramatize a little bit of it, but that's to be expected. But the basic story was good, and likewise with Apollo, the movie called First Man. And I watched this Apollo 11. I call it a documentary. I'm not sure what the exact title of it is. It's advertised as Apollo 11 in our local area. But it basically shows the real people on the consoles doing stuff. You know, we're all frozen in time there, so to speak, and that's a good thing.
Did you have any thoughts about, gosh, everybody looked pretty young back then? Or?
Well, I think that frequently people all the time say, and I saw you on TV today, and boy, you know, you look. They usually say, I look, you haven't changed a bit, but that's to say that, hey, you look like you're 80 years old back then. But I know that that's not true, because I've looked at them and I see it.
Mm-hmm.
I know everybody probably asks you about, did you ever think that it would be 50 years later and we're still talking about whether we should or should not go to the moon? People say, we expected to be on Mars by this time.
I've kind of given up on that kind of thinking, but I would have guessed that we would be a lot further along than we are now.
Do you have any thoughts about what the current administration and what NASA is talking about now with the moon initiative and having people land on the moon by 2024, whether that's doable? People were saying
you can do a lot of things if you have, as Jerry Driven was saying, if you got the resources and the will and all these other things come together, you can make it happen. That's what happened in Apollo 11. But you have to have all of those.
Do you feel like...
Right now, I don't see that actually happening, but maybe it'll be better.
That was Milt Windler, one of the flight directors on the Apollo 11 mission. Next up, let's hear Alan Boyle's conversation with Jerry Griffin.
Hi, I'm Jerry Griffin, and I was a flight director in the Apollo years.
Are there things that you want to make sure people know about the story that maybe they don't see in the movies, or is there something that people have to watch for in the movies just to know what it's all about in terms of your involvement in the space effort?
I think by and large, everything that I've seen so far is okay. Not everybody gets it exactly right, but the fact that they're talking about it is probably as important as anything 50 years later. And it's good that a few of us are still around to be able to straighten out some of it if asked. But I think most of the stuff I've seen has been pretty good. 50 years ago, none of us ever saw this coming, that there would be this kind of interest. But I really think it must have hit a tone somewhere that this happened 50 years ago, and we better not let it go. This is a good occasion to bring it to the forefront again.
I'm sure people always ask you whether you thought we would be in the position that we're in with the space effort, 50 years after Apollo. Some people say, I thought we would have been on Mars by now. Well, how do you answer that question?
I'll tell you a story. On Apollo 17, I was lead flight director for that flight, and we had done the landing, we'd done the EVAs, we had actually gotten off the moon and were headed home. And the trans-Earth phase is usually, thankfully, pretty quiet. So there, a group of us were, it was quiet, and a group of us assembled around my console, and we were talking about the fact, well, if we get these guys down and get them on the carrier, it's over. And we were kind of saying, well, it's kind of sad. But then we were saying, I can remember several people, and that's the way I felt. I said, well, maybe it's time to move on, because, shoot, 20 years from now, we'll be on Mars. And that was 1972. So that would have been 1992. We missed a little bit. But we really did think, I thought, that we would just keep on going. Now, I wasn't quite as savvy to the political structure as I became later. And that would have been tough to go on and do it in 20 years. We could have done it with the resources. I don't think there's any doubt. And now we've gotten pretty slow with it all, and it's happening slowly, and I just hope we can get it done. We got to get back into deep space, and I think the moon is the right place to go first. It's been 50 years since we've been that far. And it's different than operating in Earth orbit. It's totally different, and it has a different feel to it. The communications is not as simple. So I really hope we go to the moon first, and that's the current plan, and then on to Mars. And those two are still baby steps. I think one day we got to go farther than that, because we're going to use this planet up. It may be 1,000 years from now, or it may be 10,000. Who knows? But we better learn how to travel in space. And if the species is going to survive, I think we may have to move off this one. That's why they're looking for Earth-like places in our universe. And they found a few that are too far away yet to know much about them. But they appear to be more like the Earth than anything else. So maybe that's a change. But I'm just talking about the, we got to get our mojo back for our momentum to go into deep space. It's different. And gosh, it's been 50 years since, and we did it and did it well 50 years ago. So we could have built on that pretty fast, but we didn't. So it's no use looking back. Let's go forward.
Recently, people have talked about maybe this being a Sputnik moment in terms of having a commercial space effort that's starting to rise, and people realizing that there might be a competition going forward. People have mentioned China and Russia as potential space rivals and how we have to keep ahead. Do you see this as a Sputnik moment? How are you feeling about this moment?
Well, I think there's some really good things about this moment that I feel good about, and that is the commercial sector stepping up like they have, and they've done some amazing things, which people tell you that this should have happened. I was saying a long time ago, even when I was in NASA, that the commercial, I was talking about the big guys, the Boeings, ought to be investing some of their own money, not the government's, in figuring out how to use this new environment. But they were all, they said it was too risky. Our shareholders wouldn't like it. And so they settled for a 5% return on a government cost-plus contract. And I can understand why they did. But having these, it's kind of interesting, having SpaceX and Blue Origin come along and just, happen to be a couple of billionaires backing them both. Made a difference because they had some deep pockets and they could do the research and the planning and all that. And I am all for it. I think they are doing, and I think what's going to happen is that ultimately the domain of low Earth orbit is going to belong to the commercial companies. And they can haul that stuff in and out of low Earth orbit as well or better than the government, probably at a lower cost. And that leaves NASA to go on deeper and quit messing around with everything, trying to do everything. Let the commercial sector pick it up.
I assume that that you've met Jeff Bezos and probably met Elon Musk as well. How do you size up those folks, and how do you compare them to the people who were involved back in the 60s?
Well, you know, they are childs of the 60s, so they, in that respect, they've got some similarities. They're entirely different personalities. And Jeff is more of a small-town boy grown up, where Elon had such an interesting background in South Africa and Canada, and so he brings a different set of skills and views of things. But both of them are extremely bright, I can tell you that. And both of them are obviously entrepreneurs. They want to do their thing with their money and then get an investment return on it. And it's not going to be easy, but they've got the resources to stick with it.
That's probably a little different, thinking about investment return from space exploration. That's almost like uncharted territory. Do you have any thoughts about how you get into that territory?
There are certain things that can, obviously, the commercial guys are, they're going to eventually make money. Right now, they're not making a lot, but they're probably at least covering expenses now, and they'll get their return. So just by providing transportation. So that's one angle right there. They're going to be launching eventually. Well, they are, in fact, SpaceX is already launching DoD satellites for the Department of Defense. They're foreign communications satellites. So now, how many companies are, the question is, how many companies are going to get, new companies are going to get into those businesses of communication and so forth? But there's already a lot there. So you're not going to get a lot of investment return on going to a planet of, or Saturn. That's going to be more of a scientific kind of thing. and you're not going to land on it either. I think we will land on Mars ultimately, and the others are maybe too hostile to put humans on in our solar system. But there will be other places where we'll find that are quieter. I do think the moon may have some commercial business buried in there that we haven't unleashed yet, but and probably could be a staging place for deeper space flight if we can figure out how to make fuel out of hydrogen and oxygen that we know is there. And so who knows? I think that's still an open question mark, but at least the commercial companies have taken this first step of getting into the transportation business of space. And that could be, you know, if they've got customers all over the world that are want to launch on their carriers, that's going to make some money for them.
Finally, do you have any lessons learned or advice for those future generations of flight directors who might be working at commercial companies or working for a NASA that's focused on deep space exploration?
Well, my word for them would be stay prepared and have fun with it. It is a fascinating business. And when you get to a point like a flight director or somebody in charge of an operation, you've got a tremendous responsibility on your hands, for one thing, and particularly when you put humans on board. It's slightly different than when you're launching a robot to Mars or something. But the basic skills are the same. It's just you got to think a little differently. And I think robotic spacecraft has a purpose and a good purpose and could be precursors to everything else we do. But ultimately, it's in our own DNA that we're going to explore. If we don't do it, the Soviets will do it, or the Russians now, or China will do it, or Japan will do it, or somebody will do it. And we can't get rid of that. I think it's with us. It's why we opened up the American West and stop at the East Coast, push the frontier. So this is pushing the frontier to new level, but same idea.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right, Alan, this has been fun hearing from really these historic figures, these people who played roles in this historic mission. How are you going to be celebrating the Apollo 11 anniversary yourself, or marking it as a journalist who follows this space?
Just trying to keep on top of the wave that there are going to be so many activities. In fact, during the week that the 50th anniversary of the Apollo mission is going on, there's a space conference in the Seattle area. And so I'll be covering that. It's the new space conference. I'm sure they'll be talking a lot about the old days, but they'll be talking even more about the new days, how you follow in the footsteps of the Apollo astronauts and what this commercial space revolution is going to mean for the next generation of exploration beyond Earth orbit.
In having these conversations with these three people who were involved in the program, did you have any flashes of insight? Like, oh my gosh, yes, why don't they do that anymore? And maybe if they went back and relearned this lesson from the old space program, it might put the current commercial or government efforts on a better footing?
I think in some ways it's a little harder, strangely, today than it was back then. People say, oh, people had to figure out how to do all these things, and now they know how to do these things. But there isn't the same sort of drive to go to the moon as there was back when there was a Cold War, and this was seen as sort of a life or death struggle or a demonstration that the American way of doing things is better than the Soviet way of doing things. I don't think that there's quite so much of that existential motivation nowadays, and so I think that's what people are going to be struggling with over the next few years. Is this really worth doing, to put it frankly?
Do you think it is?
I think it is, but I think that it's not the sort of thing that needs to be done immediately. It's kind of like saving up for a new car or planning for your next house. It's something that is, or doing something about climate change. I think that that is a really good analogy, because it's something that if you don't do it, you're not going to be affected immediately, but when the time comes for us to get off this rock, we've got to know how to do it. You know, whether it's an asteroid strike like Elon Musk talks about, or whether it's just that Earth's resources become scarce and we have to find another source for energy and for materials, as Jeff Bezos says, that is his motivation for trying to make a start to getting our civilization active beyond Earth, because we've got to do it somehow to get the energy that we need for future generations. And so I think that's what's going to make it hard. And I think it's definitely worth doing. It's definitely worth spending money on. But you have to weigh that with the more immediate needs of our civilization. You can't say, oh, we're just going to spend everything to go to the moon or to go to Mars or whatever. We need to take care of this Earth too. And so that's the balancing act.
Alan Boyle, GeekWire's aerospace and science editor, thanks very much for sharing these interviews with us and also for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to GeekWire, and we hope you enjoyed our contribution to the Destination Moon pod crawl. Continue your journey through the past, present, and future of spaceflight by checking out the Flight Deck podcast from the Museum of Flight, Sound Effect from KNKX Radio, Radiotopia's The Truth, and Stuff You Missed in History Class. All of these podcasts are featuring space-themed stories that commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. You can check out our show notes for links to all of the other stops on this special pod crawl. If it's your first time listening to GeekWire, be sure to check out our site at geekwire.com for daily news about space, science, technology, and more through the lens of Seattle and the Pacific Northwest. Also, be sure to follow coverage from Alan Boyle, GeekWire's aerospace and science editor, at geekwire.com/space, and subscribe to the GeekWire podcast in your favorite podcast app. This episode was reported by Alan Boyle and produced by me, Todd Bishop. Our music is by Daniel L.K. Caldwell. We'll talk to you next time on GeekWire.
What a moment. Man on the way to the moon.